Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Reading from Canto 1, Chapter 12. Texts 7 through 10. Chapter 12 is Birth of Emperor Prakshit, and the beginning of Chapter 12 that I just completed. It's describing the beginning of Maharaj Yudhisthira's reign as king, and the opulence and the piety and the satisfaction of all the citizens. Gives a picture of his qualification as king. Text 7 starts another section. Text 7 is the attack of the Ramastra on Maharaj Prakshit. And the Supreme Lord appears. So the translation for text 7. O son of Bhrigu, Shaunaka. When the child Parikshit, the great fighter, was in the womb of his mother, Uttara, and was suffering from the burning heat of the Brahmastra thrown by Ashvatthama, he could observe the Supreme Lord coming to him. Prabhupada describes in the purport of the gestation period of the child in the womb. He calls the first 7 months trance. It's not the way that we normally think of trance, like the trance of a great yogi or something. It's the situation where consciousness is not extinguished but suspended. Susupti, deep sleep, where one isn't conscious of anything. The consciousness is still there because the soul is there. And then, after 7 months, another stage of consciousness, or what he's calling here to. They become conscious of it. Get out. Sense that they're kidding. Belly. Getting out of the womb. And it describes when state, the Brahmastra, of Ashvatthama struck. And when the Brahmastra of Ashvatthama struck, by the prayers of Maharaj Parikshit and by the prayers of Uttara, the personality of Godhead not only made an arrangement for his protection, but he personally appeared. It was deliberate, because he could do what he had to do without appearing, but he appeared because he wanted to give his darshan to Maharaj Parikshit. What the verse is saying is that he could then see, he could not only sense, but he could see, someone else has come to my rescue to protect me from this. And even the Lord's protection was there, still it was hot. It was unendurable, unbearable temperature. And put a small child, so tender, not even outside the womb yet, in contact with intense, scorching temperature, he was able to endure it. He's unbearable, unendurable, he endured it. And Prabhupada's reasoning is because he had this vira. He was a great fighter. And great fighters like some intense situation. It's like brahmanas like austerity. And kshatriyas like a fight. It's not like they're intimidated by a fight. Oh, here comes a fight. They like it. And if there isn't a fight, they go find one. They find a wrestler to wrestle with, or they do some sporting so they can at least have some practice at fighting. They like it. Like a Vaishya. To just look at anything, and they're thinking how to make some money. Just they're liking the disposition. Maharaj Parikshit was such a great fighter that even within the womb, it was his nature. But the opposition was invincible. Brahmastra was invincible, so the invincible Lord counteracted the invincible Brahmastra. And then it describes what he looked like, and his height, and what he was doing. His height was the height of a thumb. And although it was very small compared to some other size, because it was even smaller than thumb size, his form was fully spiritual. His complexion was beautiful, blackish, infallible body. He had a garment, a dress of lightning yellow. He had a helmet looking like blazing gold. So lightning yellow, blazing gold. This was seen by the Lord. His hands, there were four of them. Earrings, similarly also, like molten gold. And his eyes were blood red with fury. As he moved about, his club constantly circled him like a shooting star. Like, the movement of a electron moving around the nucleus. Prabhupada doesn't speak about his eyes appearing blood red. In contrast, when Arjuna comes back, captures Ashvatthama, his eyes are blood red, and the Lord's eyes are lotus. Here the Lord's eyes are blood red. And he's come for a mission. One is two missions, darshan, former friction, and protection. In the purport, Prabhupada discusses how the Lord enters. In the Brahma Samhita, there's a description that he enters within the halo of the universe. What's the halo of the universe? Like aura or something. And because he's already within the universe as Garbhadakshay Vishnu, therefore there's the halo. And he enters within that halo, or the radiance around the universe, and distributes himself as Paramatma within every atom, within the heart of every living being. In this way, he's all pervasive. Krishna is all pervasive in several ways simultaneously. In the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, he's the all pervasive. It's clarified in the purports. Through his energy, he's all pervasive. He's also all pervasive as Paramatma. And he's also all pervasive as Brahman, because everything rests in Brahman, although Brahman rests in Krishna. The impersonalists, they only take one meaning of all pervasive. That's Brahman. Because as far as they're concerned, there isn't such a thing as energy. All there is Brahman. And there's not Paramatma either, because all there is Brahman. It's very dull, as far as I can see. Very dull. Because he's all pervasive, it was effortless. It wasn't a big deal for him to appear. He writes, entered the womb of Uttara. He didn't exactly. He's already all pervasive, so he doesn't have to go when he, it's like enter, it's like you enter the room. You're out of the room, you go through the doorway, and you're in the room. It's like, you know, past and present. And there's time and there's space. But for the Supreme Lord, he entered into the womb of Uttara. He was already there. As a new devotee, I used to ponder, from whence did this Parama, this form of, did he come from the heart of Maharaj Parikshit? Did he come from the spiritual world? Or did he, you know, and then where did he go to when he disappeared? But it's all pervasive. And so he doesn't have to appear from anywhere or go to anywhere. He just made himself visible and then withdrew that vision or that ability to be seen. So that, conversely, what that means is that at any moment, I mean, having darshan of Lord doesn't take going to a place of pilgrimage. It takes the will of the Lord deciding to disclose himself. And why would he decide to disclose himself except that there is one who is qualified and he wants to disclose himself to a qualified person? And why should he disclose himself to an unqualified person. I mean, he could if he wants to. But the unqualified person wouldn't have the capacity to recognize him, even if he did. Like Madhavendra Puri, when the small cowherd boy in Braja came and brought him a pot of milk. And later, Madhavendra Puri realized, that was my Lord, and I didn't even recognize him. Not because he was not a pure devotee, but even recognizing the Lord, if he wants to, conceal his identity, then he'll conceal his identity. When we were in Champahati, we were speaking about the pastime of the Lord disclosing himself to the wife of Jayadeva Goswami, when Jayadeva Goswami is writing Gita Govinda. He was writing his realization, but at the same time wasn't like it wasn't exactly like he was experiencing Krishna's pastimes and he just wrote them down, as it appears that that's what Rupa and Sanatana Goswami were doing. Rupa Goswami had such a capacity, he could see Krishna's pastimes taking place within his heart, as described in Bhakti Radhakar, and then he would write it. And those pastimes are non-different, spiritually non-different, than his pastimes when he manifests to everybody. So Jayadeva Goswami was writing about exchanges with Radha and Krishna, very confidential. And Radharani had become angry with Krishna, and Krishna couldn't pacify Radha. So he came to a place where he was writing that Krishna came and placed his head at Radharani's feet, and he couldn't write it. He thought of the phrase that rhymed with the previous one. It came to his mind, but he put his writing instrument down. That he's the Supreme Lord. And it's Leela, but still he's the Supreme Lord. And how can the Supreme Lord place his head in? So he stopped. And he told his wife he's going to do his midday duties, take bath and come back. And almost as soon as he had gone, he came back. And he went right to his desk, sat down, and finished the very line and the very words that Jayadeva Goswami had intended to write but couldn't write. And he got up and left. And then some time passed and he came back again. I forget, maybe he even sat down and took his meal. Then he came back and said, well, why are you back so soon? His wife said. He said, what do you mean? What to do? So well, you came back and you sat down and you, with your instrument, you wrote. And he sat, went to the desk and saw the very words that he hadn't spoken them. It was just in his mind, the very phrase that he had intended to use to indicate Radha placing his, Krishna placing his head at Radha's feet. So he could understand this was Krishna appearing as looking just like Jayadeva Goswami. Krishna can appear just like the calves and the cowherd boys. Why he can't appear just like Jayadeva Goswami? So he told his wife, you're the most fortunate person, you've seen Krishna, although it looked like me. Krishna can appear for the benefit of his pure devotee however he likes. And there is no difference between Prabhupada's writing. There's no difference between that appearance of Krishna as the calves and cowherd boys, or Krishna's appearing as Jayadeva Goswami, or Krishna appearing as the thumb-like Lord Vishnu with his forearms and his club moving like a shooting star, or Lord Narayan in Vaikuntha. And then he goes into the deity form of the Lord. Because he starts off by saying, in a shape just suitable to Maharaj Parikshit's vision, although he was in a most awkward position, barely just gained consciousness in the womb of his mother, here comes a Brahmastra, so hot, so unendurably hot. But he's just a small child in a size suitable for that small child, exactly for the circumstance. And Krishna is able to do something like that simultaneous with being bigger than the biggest and smaller than the smallest. And not only he can do both, but he can do both simultaneously. He's from the pores of his body, universes are coming, and he's smaller than the atom at the same time. Anora aniyamsam anusmaratyaha. Smaller than the smallest, and bigger than the biggest. Beyond the scope of the mind to conceive. We can't think of something like that. You can think of something small. You can think of something big, but to think of, it's like, you know, it's binary. It's either one or zero, but it can't be. How can it be one and zero? And how can you think one and zero at the same time? You go back and forth fast, but you can't think of two at the same time. And the deity form of the Lord is being presented here as like that also. As it was mercy for Maharaj Parikshit to see the form of the Lord in that small size, it's mercy incarnation, Prabhupada describes, not here but elsewhere, the deity form, because living entities that are incapable devotees, that's what Prabhupada writes, just to accept service from his different incapable devotees. So Maharaj Parikshit was very capable, and we're not so capable. We can't endure the unendurable. Maharaj Parikshit can. So that the merciful dimension is in ingredients that are perceptible to our senses, he can manifest himself and directly receive our worship. And it's even different than the worship of an installed deity of Krishna or Vishnu Tattva is different even than the other types of deity worship. Like all over Bengal, we were just there, they were just finishing Kali Puja, and everywhere there's like Kali Murtis made of mud and straw and stuff, and they dump them in the river.
Advaita Acharya's residence in Shantipur. There's a nice event that took place in his childhood before he lived in Shantipur. His father, Kuvera Pandit, lived in a place some distance away, and the local king had a son who was of the same age as, he wasn't called the Dvaitacharya at the time, Kamalaksha. You know, the Kshatriya and the Brahmin, his son, they went to school together. And the Kshatriya's son, the prince, complained to his father, the king, that this boy, Kamalaksha, he won't pay his obeisances to Durga. You know, in Bengal, you won't pay your obeisances to Durga, you're bad. So the king then spoke to Kuvera Pandit, his father, and together they came and spoke with Kamalaksha. He said, "This is my dear boy, this is a religious function to offer your respects to Durga. Can't you do that?" And his reply was, "I can do that, but if I do that, you'll have to accept the consequences." And the king thought, arrogant little boy, "Very well, we'll accept the consequences. You offer your obeisances to Durga." And as he was offering his obeisances to Durga, the deity exploded. The parts of the deity went flying all over the place. And Kamalaksha turned to his father and said, "This village is going to be destroyed. We should leave here quickly." So his father moved to Shantipur. It's like Jed Barak, when he was being offered as a human sacrifice because they thought he was like, you know, like an animal. An avaduta, just, he won't respond, deaf and dumb, make a sacrifice. Deity was enraged. Or the big Vijay Pandit Keshava Kashmiri. He had this benediction from, because he was an ardent worshipper of Saraswati, that whenever he would debate with somebody, she would decorate his tongue with just the appropriate words to defeat any opponent. So when he was engaged in debate with, or discussion, not debate, just discussion with Nimai Pandit, and Nimai Pandit challenged, in a nice way, but challenged Digvijaya that he had made mistakes in his poetry. When Nimai Pandit pointed out the faults in one of his prayers and glorification of the Ganges, Keshava Kashmiri was speechless. He just couldn't say anything. So all the boys were laughing, Nimai Pandit students. And Nimai said, no, he's a great scholar, you shouldn't do like that. And then he turned to Keshava Kashmir and said, "This has been a very wonderful discussion. We so much appreciated your wonderful prayers and glorification of the Mother Ganges. Please come back again tomorrow so we can discuss some more." He was very humble, very polite. And that evening when he was doing his worship of Saraswati, he was offering very intense prayers, saying, "This has never happened before. I was totally humiliated by a boy. I've met great scholars all over the land and defeated everyone, and you've always been there for me, as they say. You've always kept that promise that you gave me, and this time you didn't." So in his dream, Kata Saraswati came and said, "You fool, my promise was that in any man that you debate, but this wasn't a man. This is my master. He's the personality of Godhead. So I can't contradict my master. So, therefore, you are speechless. I withdrew my potency for you to speak anything. And in fact, you made a great offense. Tomorrow, you should go place your head at the feet of that Nimai Pandit and beg his forgiveness. In fact, you should become his student. Keshe let Kashmiri become the student of a teenager. But he wasn't just a teenager, he's the personality of Godhead. He came back the next day and placed his head at Nimai Pandit's feet, begged his forgiveness. Didn't say on his dream. And according to Chaitanya Bhagavat, over a period of time, he became a great devotee. Lord Chaitanya gave him the instruction, use your erudition to write wonderful descriptions of the personality of Godhead. The idea I'm bringing up is that demigod worship is not the same as deity worship of the personality of Godhead. Deity worship of the personality of Godhead. Abhinatvam nama namino, just like the name of Krishna and Krishna are not different, the form of Krishna and Krishna are not different. So the deity worship of Durga and Goddess Kali, they end this, you know, this, the festival time of taking ceremoniously, taking the deity and throwing the deity in the river or lake or whatever. Or just leave it out to rot. Sometimes they do that. If they do it religiously, that's what they do. Submerge the deity in water. We don't do that with Krishna. His form is all spiritual. And to those who are materialists, he appears otherwise. And then Prabhupada makes this very interesting point. Such an archivigraha of the Lord is never to be considered material. For the Supreme Lord, there is no difference between matter and spirit. Although there is a gulf of difference between the two in the case of the conditioned living being. So Krishna can transform matter to spirit and spirit to matter. For him, there's no difference. Depends upon the observer, the consciousness of the observer, and that to the observer it appears accordingly. He concludes, for the Lord there is nothing but spiritual existence. And similarly, there is nothing except spiritual existence for the pure devotee of the Lord in his innate relation with the Lord. When I've been, I feel like I've just come from the spiritual world or something, being in this yatra in Mayapur. It's just my thoughts are naturally filled with Gauralila. With his devotees, particularly before he took sannyas, his identity as the personality of Godhead was concealed. But as he was taking sannyas, he made arrangements for Vishnu Priya and Gauridas Pandit and Dvijavani Nath, that they would have deities of him. And when they would see those deities, they would see him. When Lord Nityananda left at the age of 12, the Brahmana gave to Padmavati, his mother, a deity of Muralidhar that he was carrying in his sannyas little bag. Very big deity, I don't know, he must have had a big bag. And handed her the deity, saying, you see this deity and you'll see your son. And then turned and walked away, and it was as if he vanished. So many Mung Kin Roy, the deity of Lord Nityananda, that he personally worshipped as a young boy, he had a dream, and in his dream Krishna appeared and said, when you take bath in the river in the morning, you will find my deity form. I want you to worship me. And, you know, endless descriptions like this for those who are in pure devotion. And for those who are materialists, they would just criticize Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Like, as if he was ordinary, as if the devotees of the Lord were ordinary. And again and again and again and again and again. We visited the place of Nukula Brahmachari. Ever hear of Nukula Brahmachari? He's not spoken of very much. But such an elevated Vaishnav that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, being so desirous of delivering the conditioned souls, that he personally manifested himself in the heart of Nukula Brahmachari. And from that time, Nukula Brahmachari manifested ecstasy like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. His complexion became golden like that of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He would chant and dance in an ecstasy of love of God, and whoever came in contact with him also became filled with prema bhakti. And the place where he lived was just a little simple place, but thousands and thousands of people thronged around to experience this ecstatic devotee. So one very sober Vaishnava, elder, discriminating devotee, pure devotee, but Shivananda saying, well, not just on face value, somebody says something and so I accept it because, wow, that's far out, sure, why not? He had this doubt. Nukula Brahmachari actually sakshad Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is within himself. So he thought of a way to test it. The way he thought to test it is, one day, without any announcement, I'll also go and be part of the crowd. And if he actually has Chaitanya Mahaprabhu within his heart, then he'll know that I've come, and he'll tell me what is my secret mantra, my personal mantra. So that's what happened. Within the crowd, thousands of people, Nukula Brahmachari sitting under a tree, told somebody, Shivananda Sain is in the crowd, go find him. Shivananda Sain, wherever you are, whoever you are, Nukula Brahmachari. So he heard his voice, heard his name being called, so he came to Nukula Brahmachari and came before him. And right away, Nukula Brahmachari said, do not doubt. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is sitting in my heart, and your four-syllable Gopal mantra is known by me. And he never said anything to anybody what the test would be, just Shivananda Singh was convinced. Like that, so many empowered devotees. And these histories are well known. It's not like, you know, Mahabharata 5,000 years ago. It's 500 years ago. The Supreme Lord can manifest himself in various ways at his will. And where there are those with pure devotion, he chooses to, and especially merciful is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to counteract the degraded influences of the age of Kali. So degraded. So much mercy is needed. So he gave his mercy to Maharaj Pariksit. And the last verse, where there's no purport, it says, the Lord was thus engaged in vanquishing the radiation of the Brahmastra, just as the sun evaporates a drop of dew. He was observed by the child who thought about who he was. So he's in pure devotion, but he's still like, and not developed consciousness, he's still a small living being within the womb. Andre, who is this? Not quite exactly like a small child who looks at somebody they don't know and just stares at them. Like, who are you? This is a pure devotee associating with his eternal master, eternal companion. And the life of Maharaj Pariksit followed like that. Okay, any discussion?
It is mentioned in the Bhagavatam that if Pariksit would have wanted, he would have sought the protection of the Lord even when he was cursed to be bitten by the snake.
Mm.
So what should be our move when some difficulties come? And how to really cultivate that mood of not seeking just protection of the bodily platform?
It depends if you're on the bodily platform or not. That's for starters. Just hearing Prabhupada, listening to these recorded lectures, he was lecturing on the same verse once, one day in Mayapur, another day in Los Angeles. There's a verse about Maharaj Yudhisthira and how he was beyond the bodily conception. And the Prabhupada was emphasizing this in both cities, both lectures. The beginning of spiritual life, and I couldn't catch the phrase he was using, but is condensed beyond, you know, theoretical. That his identity is not this body. And that's the beginning of spiritual life. Brahman. Brahma-tattva, knowledge of Brahman. So, I was having this discussion with a devotee about, you know, being striving for pure devotion where we don't ask the Lord for anything other than pure devotion, you know, access to his devotional service. And what about when somebody's not on that platform? Then it's natural, they ask for something material, rather than pretend that they're not. So it was a nice discussion. The answer to your question is that everything depends upon the developed stage of consciousness, or the evolved state of consciousness that one has. So, let's just say the evolved state of consciousness is mixed. Some faith in the eternal, and some identification with the temporary. So, if one seeks protection from some danger, some immediate physical present danger, that looks like mixed devotion. But if to whatever degree the consciousness can go to, so that I can go on serving Krishna, you know, take it down to, why do we eat? Why do we sleep? Why do we bathe? Why do we do the everyday things that we do? And it can be, well, I want to be healthy, I don't like to be sick. But Now, it can be material or spiritual mixed. When there's an imminent danger, our thoughts should at once go to Krishna. No, we're riding around all over West Bengal with a cab driver that thought he was a cowboy. You know, American kind of cowboy, not the coward, you know, Braja cowboy, cowherd boy. And, you know, screeching the brakes, and, you know, some truck is suddenly passing and coming at you at full steam. So, thought you need to go to Krishna. Not just, oh, please save me from this danger, but intense situation, a dangerous situation. Thought goes to Krishna. Naturally. And the thought that how much of the thought is, oh, please protect me, versus how much the thought is, you know, we're depending upon you, Krishna. You're everything. So if you want to take me, you can take me, but I want my thoughts to be with Krishna. It's so much of it is the consciousness that we cultivate in what we do every day. Why do you study? Why do you chant? Why do you sing Dhammadharastagam prayers? Why do you... And you can become complacent, or you can be in ecstasy. Or it can be ritualistic. I was exhausted from our yatra. So yesterday I was in Calcutta and took rest early and got up early. It was 2 o'clock, and by 3 o'clock, across the street, there was some people, apparently Gaudiya Vaishnavas, banging on the gong and playing the wampers and, you know, having their mangalarti and having bhajans and Tulsi Puja and around, and, you know, they're enthusiastic. It wasn't just ritualistic. I don't know what level of Krishna consciousness they were, but they were happy. A bunch of them. So each of the day to day activities that we do should be done in Krishna consciousness. And then when danger comes, we face that in Krishna consciousness. And what is our goal? That's also very important to maintain clear focus upon. If we don't keep clear focus upon goal, then the immediate becomes, you know, the small picture rather than the big picture becomes our focus, and that's, you know, the immediate danger. And then our life becomes more involved in the material energy and managing the material energy rather than staying Krishna conscious, the mission of life. So what consciousness we carry will determine how we approach some facing of some obstacle. It's not just the removal of the obstacle that's going to make us happy or prove that Krishna loves us or something like that. In a confidential, in a very close, loving relationship. Even with another person, when another person does something or says something, or it seems like, oh, here's a challenge for me, it becomes altogether different if it's a loving relationship. It's different. A combat situation, or a win-lose situation, or a something like that, becomes its altogether different thing. And that's what Krishna consciousness is. Obstacles become opportunities for surrender. To sharpen and focus our attention more, our dependence more. That's what an obstacle is. It's part of a relationship with Krishna. Right?
Just carrying on this question further, sometimes we want to seek protection for our maintaining the consciousness on our dependence on Krishna, but there seems to be some like a pattern, some difficult circumstances come and then the dependence is lost and become more mechanical during that time. So how to actually during those...
Is that during those periods of time? The frame of your question is almost the same as what somebody else asked during a question-answer session in Mayapur. When things come up with some repetition, it's important to note that there's repetition, and that you give extra attention. Not just to how you pass through the circumstance, but what's triggering, this repeated refrain, the names and the faces are different, but the challenge is the same challenge. It's Krishna's wanting a certain lesson. There's something inside me, some kind of impurity that I need to address. And until I address this, it's going to keep happening. So it's not just like how you stay on the surfboard when the wave gets really high, or whatever it is, how you can win the sport, whatever the challenge is, meet the challenge. It's not that. It's something that's inside. Krishna's letting you know by this refrain-like circumstance. So you stay in a position of dependency, primarily, calling out. And, appealing to Krishna for the intelligence and the strength. Not only to understand how to hold on tight through the challenge, but what is there in this experience that Krishna is wanting me to understand about my relationship with Him, my sense of whatever it might be, control of the material energy when I'm not at all a controller, or some insensitivity to another person when they're in a certain circumstance. So whatever it is, something that needs correction. Let me follow that. Stay with the circumstance and try to find its very root and address it. Turn it around. And supposing you're training somebody and you notice time and again there's a certain something, there's a certain behavior. It's not just the behavior is the issue, there's something behind the behavior. And you, as a trainer, want to get to that. So same within ourselves. The material energy is just acting out. And there's something that's prompting that acting out. What's that something? You know, like a little grain of sand. And that little grain of sand is rubbing. And it hurts. Move that grain of sand. Go right to the root and address it. And that's not easy to do ourselves. It's something we need to try to do ourselves, but therefore we have others who are guiding us and training us. Recently heard Prabhupada in a lecture saying, the person who is the editor should not be the one who is the writer. Because the person who wrote something, it looks okay. But another person, you know, sees it from another perspective, and therefore the editor should be another person besides the writer. But then, another Gaura Lila, when Ishwara Puri was visiting in Mayapur, Gadadhar Pandit, who was devotional from childhood, immediately latched on to Ishwara Puri, and every day Ishwara Puri had written one book, I forget the name, Krishna Karnamrita or something like that, and he would discuss his book, Pastimes of Krishna, Topics of Krishna, Krishna Katha. And then one day Ishwara Puri was walking with Gadadhar, and saw over there under that tree there's all those students and that one boy who's the teacher. Who's that one boy? Gadadhar said, oh, that's Nimai Pandit. Ishwara Puri said, oh, I've heard of this Nimai Pandit. Could you introduce us? So Gadadhar Pandit introduced Nimai to Ishwara Puri. Immediately Nimai said, oh, my father would be very happy if you could come and visit our home and take your meal. Can I extend an invitation? So he came and he served him. And Ishwara Puri then said, I hear that you're very expert in grammar. You're the best. Could I ask some service from you? Can you look at my manuscript and let me know if there's any mistakes? Nimai said, I can't. Sure. No, I want you to do this as a service. So they sat every day and he heard from Ishwara Puri. This went on for a couple of months, and one day Nimai said, that phrase you just used, and pointed out something that grammatically was not just right. And Ishwara Puri said, well, let me think about this. We'll discuss tomorrow. And Ishwara Puri came back the next day and said, so I thought very carefully, and it's exactly what I meant to say. So Nimai Pandit accepted defeat, and he was very happy. He, who would always debate everybody, was happy to be defeated by Ishwara Puri. So to help us correct something that's an ongoing or a repeated thematic-like thing, those are especially important. whatever it might be, to examine within, take assistance from someone else, qualify somebody else, help us see whether it's at something and remove the problem at its root, not just manage the problem.
So as in the condition state, actually we don't have so much feelings for the Lord, for deities or anything, but when we worship, so what should be our mood of worshiping by offering anything, what should be our mood?
One thing, one simple thing that you can do is be reflective. Like, what are we doing? Because otherwise it's just external. So, you know, to whatever degree you can go internal, while doing the external, do that. Meditate on the meaning of the words. Entering into the mood of the meaning of the words that accompany the worship. Step back from the withdrawing of exactly. Stand as an observer of what you're doing. You know, the body is doing this and the mouth is doing that kind of thing. And what's the essence of what we're now doing? You like to cook, right? So, the beginning part of learning cooking is recipes, technique, temperature, cleanliness, you know, the technical things. And that can only carry you so far. It's when you enter into the mood of what it is that you're doing, you're taking something that's given by Krishna and you're making it so nice to offer to Krishna. You enter into the devotional, the bhakti spirit. And as you can do that, or the more that you can do that, then it's not just mechanical anymore. You're still attentive to the detail, but you're far more than attentive to the detail. You're entering into what the service of cooking is meant for, an expression of offering to Krishna. So same with deity worship. Go beyond the external. You know, so it's your consciousness. Let your consciousness be active at an internal level. So you can start with, you know, the medical and then go to the transcendental. So be clean, be punctual, and, you know, the medical things. Be respectful. And then go internal in the message of, the mood of, the spirit of the activity. It's meant to be pleasing to Krishna. That's what it's for. We went to is Champahati. There's a deity of Gorga Dadhar in Champahati that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu manifested for Dvijavaninath some 500 years ago, and they had their whereabouts was lost. So Bhaktisiddhanta in 1930 found the deities. They were existing, but they were existing in a old dilapidated straw structure that some mean-eating person would, who called himself a Brahmin, would go once a week and ring a bell and place some water, kind of like in a ritualistic way, and then disappear. Anyway, he purchased the land and established a temple in that place where the deities could.